Hello everyone, welcome back to Computer Science E7. I'm sorry that we've moved yet one more time, but this should hopefully be the final resting place for the rest of the semester. If there are a couple of handouts, if you don't have them already, there's a new assignment. So just as you turn in assignment one, there's actually assignment two that's been released. And there's also just some lecture slides with some section for notes. And if you remember a few lectures ago, I was talking a lot about backups and backing up your photographs and all of this stuff. Well, guess what happened? One of my backup drives failed just a couple of weeks ago, and I went through this whole ordeal of having to get it replaced under warranty. And luckily, it was just the backup drive, not the main one, but it was such a pain to just to have to deal with bringing up the backup yet again. And I feel like this is perfect opportunity for me to say, oh, look, these drives fail all the time, so if you don't have anything... If you don't have everything backed up yet, do it, because it's a nasty surprise when it happens, and it can really be quite the pain. So like I mentioned, we have assignment two is out this time, and it's very similar to assignment one in that there are three parts. There's a problem set like part with a bunch of problems, and there's a portion where you have to take some photographs and submit them, and there's also a portion on the forum. It's just slightly different in this case, whereas in the first assignment, you were to find a photograph that you liked as sort of an initial assignment or the first thing to do and post it to the forum. This time, while you were taking photographs, you may find that you're having difficulty with one or more of your photographs, and you're supposed to just pick one that you're having difficulty with, upload it to the forum, and other people will respond and hopefully give you some tips on what you can change about it and do it slightly differently. And the motivation here is not to necessarily be annoying with having to constantly go to the forum and deal with uploading photographs and all this, but just to get a new perspective on your photographs and to get some additional fresh ideas on what you can change or what you can do differently. And certainly that will hopefully help mold your understanding about how you take photographs and certainly at least give you a new perspective on how you can proceed with that. You'll probably notice that the problem set portion, part one, is a bit longer and a bit more involved this time. And that's because we're starting to get into some really good meaty stuff now. And so we have more questions to ask. And last time I got a little premature with putting a couple of questions that we hadn't yet gone over, but those are now in this one, and we're picking up from there. So if you have any questions, do feel free to ask, but it should hopefully be relatively straightforward. So this is lecture four, Exposure Continued. So two weeks ago, we just went over some of the basic exposure settings, just what all of the various things are that go into making an exposure, or into making a photograph, and how it affects exposure. So the first thing that we talked about was shutter speed and how it can impact a photograph. So shutter speed is how long the shutter is open, just as a quick review. And so if the shutter is open for longer, which means a slower shutter speed, then you get more motion blur. If it's not open for as long, you can freeze motion, as in this image here, but then you have less light entering the camera. So one of the things that I mentioned when using a very long shutter speed, or when the shutter is open for a very long time, is to use a tripod. But I don't think I mentioned a setting that many SLR cameras have that can be very, very useful, and it's called MLU, or the mirror lockup. So remember, if you remember the anatomy of an SLR camera, there's a mirror in here that has to flip up out of the way, and the shutter has to open in order to allow light to pass through the lens and into the sensor or the film in order for you to capture an image. But what happens is that mirror has a certain amount of mass, it has a weight, and so as it moves up, it has momentum. And when it hits the top of the camera, that momentum has to go somewhere. So it's distributed throughout the camera. The camera actually just very slightly shakes, just ever so subtly. You probably wouldn't notice it. You might feel it slightly if you're holding the camera, but you generally don't think of it as being a problem. And certainly for photographs where you have a very high shutter speed, that's really not going to be so much of an issue. But when you take longer photographs, or photographs where the shutter is open for maybe about an eighth of a second or longer, then that is the perfect amount of time for these vibrations to affect the image in the camera. So there is a solution to this called mirror lockup, where you can turn on mirror lockup, and what will happen is, I can demonstrate it here. You usually have to go into the settings of a camera and, let's see, then turn on, so I can't show it to you, but there's a setting called mirror lockup, and then I can turn it on. And so now what will happen is when I click the shutter button to open the shutter, the first thing that happens is the mirror goes up, but it doesn't start taking the photo yet. So the shutter is essentially still closed. So after some amount of time, then I can hit the shutter button again, and you'll notice that there was a smaller click, it's just a much softer click that happened with the second touch. And what happens is that was the shutter opening. So the first one is the mirror moving up and out of the way, and you can give it some time to let the vibrations move throughout the camera and settle. Then the second one is the shutter opening. Then when you release, so I have it in bulb mode, so I have to hold the shutter open in order to keep the shutter open on this camera so it'll take the image. But you can see why this will be very useful to get rid of some of these vibrations. Yes?
In this case, you no longer can use the lens glasses and follow the subject.
Right, exactly. So the downside to this is that while the mirror is up, so if I do it again here, if I were to look through the viewfinder, since the mirror is up, there's no light coming through the viewfinder, so I can't actually see what's happening through the lens. So luckily, since this is a problem that really only affects longer shutter speeds, generally what happens is you frame it anyway, and the camera will have to be still anyway. So when you take the photograph, you're not going to be missing too much. And you really don't have to wait a long time after the mirror has flipped up and out of the way. Maybe a second or less is fine. The problem is that if you... I lost my train of thought. So if you flip the lens out of the way and then you touch the camera again to open the shutter, obviously your finger is doing some movement on the camera as well. And so you could get this same problem where you're causing a slight vibration in the camera. So this, again, is a reason to get one of these remotes for your camera, where you can plug in the remote into the camera and fire the shutter just off the camera without needing to touch the camera itself. And so you can completely eliminate vibrations this way. Generally, there's a range where the mirror lockup is useful. So it's usually between about an eighth of a second and a full second long, where this will really impact the quality of the photograph. Much longer or much faster than that, so if you have maybe a 2 second photograph, for example, or even a 1/16th second or 1/15th second exposure, for example, you really aren't going to notice the effects as much. So it's this sort of eighth of a second to a second range where you will notice it the most and where you will really need to use the mirror lockup. But certainly I would argue that if you're going to use a really long shutter speed anyway, or if you're going to use a really long amount of time to keep the shutter open, that you should use mirror lockup anyway, just to make sure that it's absolutely sharp as you can possibly make it. Some cameras don't actually require a setting. It actually has a separate button for it. You'll have to refer to your camera's documentation to see how you can do it, if at all. And of course, it doesn't really apply to smaller compact digital cameras where there is no mirror to move up and out of the way. That problem just does not exist in this case. Okay, so then we talked about ISO. Oh, yes,
yeah,
question.
My camera does a little differently. It has shutter delay. Press the button, the mirror goes up immediately, then either 2 or 12 seconds later, the shutter goes off.
Yeah, so there are different ways to do it. So on this camera, for example, I have mirror lockup enabled, but if I set the timer on it, so rather than it being a 10-second timer, I hit the shutter button, and then I have to take it off bulb mode. Bulb mode, probably. So let's see. I'll just make it for a couple of seconds. So what happens is there's a 2-second delay. When I first hit the shutter button, then the mirror moves up. After 2 seconds, then the shutter opens. And so that 2 seconds is enough time. That is another way, without needing to use a remote, that you can eliminate the vibration of your finger pushing the button itself. So there's different ways of accomplishing this mirror lockup, and different cameras will do it different ways. Luckily, I have a choice on mine, and I guess it really depends on the camera whether or not you can do it a different way. So yeah, you can do it with a timer as well, which is pretty useful as well. Okay, so the other thing that affects exposure besides shutter speed is ISO, or the sensitivity of the sensor. So as you increase the ISO, you get additional noise, but then you can also, as you increase the sensitivity, you can perhaps increase the shutter speed. So you can have the shutter open for less time so that you can freeze action, for example, and vice versa. Aperture. This was the sort of difficult math that we had to go through, but if you just remember the F number, the range of the F numbers, you start from 1 and 1.4 and you double each, so you get 2, 2.8, 4, 5.6, so on and so forth, and it's pretty easy to remember what is one stop difference between each of the F numbers. And aperture, of course, affects not only the amount of light entering through the camera, but the amount of background blur that you get. And so hopefully, as you were trying this out on your cameras or through the Church Street Lab camera for assignment one, you probably noticed that different cameras will behave differently when you're modifying the aperture. The smaller the camera, generally the less pronounced the effect is. And with the bigger camera, particularly with SLRs, you really can notice the effect of a change in F number, a really large change in the depth of field. Yes?
Is there a difference between, for instance, there, I've seen big F and then a number, and then say a small F over a number, a fraction of a number. So is there a difference with the Panasonics at Church Street? And when you set the F number, it might say like F3.2. Is that F over 3.2 or just F3.2?
Okay, so there's a couple of ways of denoting the F number. So what we call the F number is just a representation of the size of the aperture. So there's a lot of terms that are used interchangeably here, where the aperture is the actual hole itself that allows the light in. Some people use aperture to mean F number, and it is what it is. It's neither right nor wrong necessarily. What's technically wrong, but it's so many people use it that it really doesn't matter. But when we are talking about the F numbers themselves, usually they're denoted by an F, usually an italics F with a slash and then the number itself, or F over something, and that's the same thing. So it's not that it's over anything, it's the same number as the F number, it's just a different way of denoting it. It's just a shorthand way of meaning the same thing. So if you see F over 3.2, for example, the F number is 3.2. So it's just a lot of different ways of saying the same thing. And many cameras won't even necessarily show you that F. They'll just give you a number, and you'll have to figure out that it's the aperture, the F number in that case, just based on the range. Okay. So the camera, though, obviously has a sense of how all of these features work and how all of these things can affect a photograph, and will be able to, especially in these automatic modes on a camera, be able to determine automatically what all of the settings should be. And it seems like an interesting thing to have to discuss. How does a camera know what settings to use? And yes, this is intentionally made gray, because this is essentially how a camera does metering, what it calls metering. And metering is essentially when a camera looks at a scene and it tries to set all of the exposure values based on the amount of light that is entering into the camera. So you notice that this is just a blank gray box, and that's essentially what the camera boils down to in terms of metering. So when you point your camera at an object or a series of objects to take a picture, light enters through the lens, and then through some fancy mirrors, it actually enters into a small metering chip where the light is measured, and then it tries to determine, based on how much light it detects, what settings it should use. And so you'll typically see references to something called an 18% gray card, where photographers will have basically just a card that looks like this, just a blank gray card. They'll ask their subject to hold the card, and then they will meter that card to determine how much exposure, what all of the exposure values should be based on the amount of light in the room. And so this can actually, there's a lot of variation here on what people claim is an 18% grade card. Sometimes you'll see it as 12%. Sometimes you'll see it as 13% or 14%. Technically, mathematically speaking, what they're referring to is a 12% grade card, but almost universally you'll hear it as an 18% grade card. So if you're looking for more information on this online and you see these sort of different percentages, don't get confused. Everybody calls it 18%, but technically it's actually a 12% grade card. And it's really annoying, but that's the way it is. And basically, what this means is that the card is reflecting 12% of the light. But what happens is that this is essentially 50% gray, a sort of middle gray between completely black and completely white. And so why it's 12% deals with the way our eyes work and the way that we perceive brightness. It's not necessarily a linear scale, so it's actually logarithmic, and so, you know, skip over all the math stuff, but basically it's 12 or 18% of the light that gets reflected. So let's say that you as a photographer are using one of these 18% or 12% gray cards, and you're using it to try to determine what all of the exposure settings should be on a camera. So you ask someone to hold this card, and then you meter the light coming from this card. So you may not necessarily use a camera for this, but they do actually have specialized meters where it will record the amount of light and tell you how much light there is. So from there, you can figure out exactly how you can vary each of these exposure settings. So you might have, so for example, this device, this metering device might tell you, okay, you are in zone 15 EV, for example, and you have a little table there and you look up that 15 EV means, okay, it's essentially the Sunny 16 rule. You can have, F16 with at ISO 100 with a shutter speed of 1/100th of a second. But this tells you just about the entire range of all of these values that you can do. If you want a larger aperture, you can decrease the F number and perhaps increase the ISO, for example, to compensate. So you can pick and choose what you want. And so this is essentially, that's the manual version of what the camera essentially does, is it gathers all of the light into it and it tries to figure out, what a very generic or neutral version of that would be. And then based on that amount of light, it figures out what all of these three settings should be set to. And so as you decrease or increase the amount of light, this gray will become brighter or darker. And so the camera will compensate for that by increasing or decreasing any of these values that will allow the exposure to be correct. And so there is actually, the camera uses different ways of being able to determine which portion of the image should be 18% gray, and these are called metering modes, and we'll talk more about this in just a second. But basically, all the camera is doing is looking at a scene, and it's trying to determine what the middle exposure should be. So remember that the sensor, or the film, has this sort of middle ground where it will appear to be perfectly gray in the photo. If it's brighter than that, then it will be brighter on film or in the camera. If it's darker than that, then it will be darker as well. And so that's why we have to adjust all of these settings to be able to make the exposure fit within this very narrow range that the camera's film or the camera's sensor can understand. Okay, so what does this actually mean? So let's break it down even further. So right now, as all of you are sitting in this room, there's light coming down from the ceiling, and the light is reflecting off of all of you in varying degrees. So those of you wearing white shirts, you're reflecting more of the light. Those of you wearing darker shirts are reflecting less light. And so there's this sort of average where if we were to look, or if we were to be a camera and look at the scene, there's this sort of middle average, which we could try to determine as being this middle gray. And so that is what the camera would think is the exposure of the room. It would then compensate all three of those settings to try to make sure that whatever light is available is entering into the lens and is captured by the sensor. So this idea of reflected light is very important. There's actually two different types of light meters, and what we have in our cameras is called reflected light. And that's essentially what I just mentioned to you. As the light bounces off of all of you, it comes into the camera and the camera measures it to try to determine how much light or what settings it should use to measure the light or to record the light in it. However, we could also record how much light is coming from the lights themselves. This is called incident light. And so if you've ever watched any of these, any behind the scenes videos on movies or photo shoots or anything like that, where you see professional photographers holding up this strange device next to the person that has a white bubble on top, this is an incident light meter, where basically it records the amount of light that's hitting the subject. And then based on that amount of light, they can try to figure out how much light will be reflected off of the person and will enter into the camera. So remember that the whole motivation for this is because the camera sensor can only record a certain amount of light. There are so many photons that will that the sensor will consider to be black through a range of, you know, 4 or probably about 2 to the 12 or 2 to the 10 times that amount of photons will be considered white. And so we have to adjust all of these exposure values to bring the light that's entering into the camera into that exact amount for the camera to be able to record. Okay, so it might sound kind of confusing, but we're going to show some examples and go over some of this stuff just so that it really makes a little bit more sense. So right now, I'm working under the assumption that the camera looks at the entire scene and tries to figure out what a middle gray might be. It might average all of the light, for example, and might say, okay, that average of the light is just this middle gray, and then it will adjust its exposure settings to be able to reflect the amount of light that's coming off of a scene. However, there are different ways that you can do it. So there are other metering modes in a camera. So this one, for example, is called spot. And so we see here that we have basically a rectangle that's, you know, a 3D rectangle that's laying flat, and we have in the middle a large amount of bias right here. So this, you can think of this rectangle as being a photograph, for example, that the camera is seeing. So right now, if I were to put this lens back on the camera and look through the lens, I would see a rectangular image. So imagine that that rectangular image is this here. So when I'm using spot metering, what the camera is going to do is look at only this narrow 3% or so of the image in the very, very center, and it will say, okay, whatever brightness is coming from this 3% in the middle, it is going to consider this middle gray, and it will adjust the settings to reflect that. So for example, let's say I'm using spot metering, and I'm pointing at someone wearing just a very neutral gray shirt. And more specifically, I'm pointing at that shirt itself or onto one of these 18% gray cards. It's for our purposes right now, you can consider them to be the same thing. Since that is sort of middle of the road, it's not super dark and it's not super bright, the camera will then be able to properly expose the scene because it will know how much light is in that scene and it will be able to adjust its exposure settings for that particular scene. However, if I were to point this spot at someone or at someone's shirt that was white, for example, then the camera will think that that white shirt is supposed to be a middle gray, and it will adjust the exposure settings so that it will make that white shirt darker. So now what would happen to the image? Right, it looks darker. It'll become underexposed. So what happens then if I point this spot at someone wearing a very dark shirt? It will think that this black or dark shirt should be middle gray, so it'll increase these, maybe the ISO, for example. So what will happen? Overexposure. Right, overexposure, exactly. So spot metering is very useful, but only when you have a neutral reference point where you know that's exactly the middle exposure for a particular location or for a particular scene. If you have an 18% gray card, for example, you'd most likely use spot and put that 18% gray card in the middle of the frame, and then you would know exactly what the exposure values should be. However, most of us don't actually operate in this spot mode. Usually, we're operating in something different, like this center-weighted mode, for example, where, sure, the center has a large bias, but it's not only the center. Things, as we move towards the outside, also have an importance as well in determining the amount of the exposure values for a particular image. So in this case, if we are pointing the center of the frame at someone's black shirt, for example, but surrounding them, it's very, very bright, now the camera will average that, and you might actually get a little bit better exposure. Because now, rather than the camera assuming that just the very center is supposed to be middle gray, so let's see, so for example, this, if this was my middle 3%, and you were to focus on this, and all of a sudden the spot meter says that this should be middle gray, so it overexposes everything. Now instead, if we were using center weighted, and I was focused on this, now it would take some of the surroundings into account as well, so that it would say, okay, well, sure, this is very, very dark, but the surroundings are also very, very bright, and so we can take an average of this to try to figure out what the exposure settings should be for a particular image. So this is really only useful, again, when your subjects are in the middle of the frame. So when you have someone who's standing right smack dab in the middle in the center, and this may or may not be ideal. Certainly, one of the things that can go wrong is if you have someone on the very outside of the frame, for example. You're trying to take an exposure, or you're trying to take a photograph of someone, and they're on the very edge of the frame, you may notice that it looks very, very bright or very, very dark, and that's because if you're using center-weighted modes, it's looking at the background of the image. So if I were standing next to this projector screen, for example, and this screen is very bright compared to me, if you were to take a photo where I am in the photo, but predominantly you are taking a photo of the projector screen, it will expose this projector screen as sort of a middle gray, and I will be very, very dark. So this can be a problem because I'm not necessarily the subject for your image. So how can you overcome this? Well, you can switch to the spot mode, and you could, maybe you could ask me to hold a gray card, or you could find some neutral spot on me that you determine is sort of a 50% level of brightness. Then you could record the exposure. And so many cameras will have what's called an auto exposure lock, so that when you're pointing at something, this is especially useful when using the spot mode, you're pointing at something, and it shows you a certain set of values. So it might say, okay, at ISO 400, we're looking at 1/20th of a second with f/2.8, for example. So then you can use this AE lock, this auto exposure lock, to lock in those values, and then you can recenter the image. So again, so that this workflow becomes clear, you could point it at me if I were holding an 18% gray card. You could then lock that exposure based on that gray card, and then you could recenter the frame so that you could recenter the image so that now not only am I in it, but also the rest of this projector or the rest of this projection. Then you can take the photograph. If you move the image, or if you move the camera without this auto exposure lock, what's going to happen is that the camera will readjust the settings based on what it sees in the center. So if you didn't have this auto exposure lock on, you looked at me and I have a certain set of exposure values, and then you move over to this projector, it will suddenly become, you'll notice that all of the values will become for a much brighter scene, which basically means that we would have to lower the ISO, lower the F number, or increase the duration. So if it's or increase the shutter speed. Okay, so anyway, if you were to look at me, do the auto exposure lock, and then recompose the image so that I'm no longer in the center, you've locked in those exposure values, you can take the photograph where I am properly exposed, and hopefully this is as well. It will at least appear very, very bright next to me. So that's one way to overcome some of these limitations. However, recently there's been a new, well, not recently, for a while they've also had another type of metering called zone metering, where essentially the camera breaks apart the photograph that you're looking at, or the scene that you're looking at, into a variety of zones. So in this case, I've broken this picture up into 9 different zones, and then it will evaluate each zone and try to determine which zone might be the most important for the image, and then base the exposure off of that. So for example, in this shot, you can see that I have focused on the people in the boat here. So that the zones now that become a lot more important are probably this zone right here, maybe that upper left-hand zone, and maybe this middle zone. But the rest, since it's out of focus, the camera can determine that it's not what I am taking a picture of. So it can then expose for these zones that are actually in focus. So the camera can use a variety of tricks. It may not only what is in focus and out of focus by determining what is in focus. Many cameras have different focus points where you can tell the camera what you want to be in focus, and then when it focuses on that, it'll use the zone associated with that focus point to try to figure out what the exposure is. It can also calculate the distance to the subject. Many of the lenses, after they are automatically focused, you'll notice that they actually know the distance from you to the subject that is being focused on. Let's see, it could use backlighting. So it could try to determine, okay, well, right here I have these couple of zones that are in focus, so this must be the subject. But the background, so it isn't in this case, but assume for a minute that the background is very, very bright. It could see that there's a lot of backlighting in the background, and it could take that into account as well. So usually when you're taking photos with one of these automatic modes, typically what you want to use is a zone mode like this, because it uses a lot of heuristics to try to determine what should be used to set the proper exposure. So many cameras these days use a lot more than just 9 zones. And it seems to be a marketing thing with some of these cameras, where some of them will announce, oh, we have 500 zones. And then a competing manufacturer will come out with a 1,024 zone metering mode. And frankly, it's getting a bit ridiculous how many zones all of these cameras are having. As long as you have the zone metering capability, that really is going to be a lot better than some of these other metering modes. But it can be somewhat frustrating trying to figure out what the camera is doing if you're really trying to break apart how this zone metering works. So every camera manufacturer has different ways of using zone metering to expose a scene properly. And so some of the things that I mentioned, such as distance, backlighting, and what is in focus and out of focus, may have different levels of importance to different manufacturers. So I can't really say... can't tell you exactly how zone metering would work in every single camera, because it's going to vary quite a bit. There is actually one additional thing that the camera could take into account, and that is the colors that are present in the scene. That deals a lot with luminance, and we will talk about luminance in just, in the next lecture, actually. So we have these different modes that are available to us, and remember that all these modes allow us to do is just tell us what the camera should look at to try to figure out is this sort of middle gray. It's not black, it's not white, it's this right in the middle gray, and it will use that to try to determine the exposure settings to use to properly take a photograph. And so all of these zones, or all of these metering modes, have different uses. Frankly, when I'm using some of the automatic modes, when I'm not using manual, I'll have the camera set on zone metering, just because it seems to have the highest percentage of well-exposed photos. However, many times you're still going to have to help the camera determine what the exposure should be. And that's where exposure compensation comes in. So there's many cases where the camera is trying to make the scene this middle gray, whether that means bringing down this white snow down to a darker gray, or bringing sort of a black textured shirt up to a lighter color. You are generally going to have to fight the camera when you have these sorts of oddball situations. And so in this case, this photo is predominantly snow, but there's some trickery here in that there's also some shadows, and that there's some people here that have relatively dark jackets on. However, you'll notice that most of the photo, just because of the way that it was shot, is actually in focus. So the camera may or may not be able to determine what the subject is in the photo. So it may just use, if it were using zone metering, which for this photograph it was, may just perhaps taken an average of the entire scene, just like this center-weighted, if we were to go back, just like this center-weighted one, it may give a lot of preference to the center of the image rather than to one particular side where the subjects of the photo are. And so you'll notice that this photo actually looks okay, but if you look at the specs down here, I had to increase what's called the exposure compensation. So there's plus 0.7 EV, which means that I told the camera that it had the wrong exposure and it needed to increase the exposure by about 2/3 of a stop. So what the camera was telling me, was that I had to use some subset of, or some set of exposure values. So right now it's at 1/800th of a second, ISO 100 and f4.5. But if it had its way, this would have had to have been 2/3 of a stop darker. So maybe it would have been, let's see, f5.6, for example, or f7, which is about 2/3 of a, well, no. Yeah, f5.6 is probably about 2/3 of a stop or 1/3 of a stop away. And so it could have told me a variety of other things. But when I took the photo, or perhaps I just knew, looking at the scene, that you would have to add or subtract some exposure compensation in order to get a properly exposed photograph. Yes?
Well, that's what I was going to ask. Like, at one point, do you know, looking at the scene, you have to go up?
So at first, you may not know how much exposure compensation to use, and that certainly is the case. As you take a lot of photographs, you'll become more comfortable with using exposure compensation and trying to figure out exactly how much you need to use. There's some general rules, like if you have a lot of snow in the image, you really have to increase the exposure compensation by 1 to 2 stops even sometimes. Snow can really do some damage to, or not damage, but it can really do a good job tricking the camera into thinking that the scene should be darker than it really is. Also, if you're taking a photo of someone that's wearing a lot of black, for example, or they're perhaps in a dark location, or you're taking a photo in a lot of shadows, the camera will try to bring up a lot of that exposure to be a lot brighter, but you may not want it to be, so you have to give it some negative exposure compensation. And so, I mean, really the easy things are stuff like snow. When you're outside in the snow, you're really going to have to dial in a lot of positive exposure compensation so that you're telling the camera that the scene is brighter than it is. So what it means is when you have positive exposure compensation, you're telling the camera that you know better than it and it's going to be brighter than it thinks it is. Negative exposure compensation is the opposite. So you're telling the camera that, okay, it's looking at a dark scene, so it should be darker. And so after a while, you'll become more comfortable with it. But in this case, you'll notice that it's only 2/3 additional exposure compensation. That's just because there's quite a bit of shadow, actually, in this particular scene. Yes?
I'm a little confused by this. You're using this exposure compensation just in automatic mode?
So there are a variety of modes that the camera has. There's the full-on manual mode, where we can set all three exposure values independently, and the camera can try to help us and tell us whether it thinks it's too dark or too bright. Pretty much every other mode that it has to that it uses involves some sort of metering. So the camera has to determine the amount of light coming in so that it can help you with one or more values that it is going to set for you. And so this usually, depending on the mode that you're using, it'll try to set all three modes, or I'm sorry, it'll try to set all three values, or it might try to set only one value, or it could try to set two values for you. And we'll go over some of the modes in just a little bit. But everything except the manual mode, really, the camera is going to be guessing or is going to try to meter the amount of light in the scene, and you have to compensate for it when necessary. So if this was a very flat sort of, not necessarily boring, but boring in terms of the change in brightness in the photograph, then I probably wouldn't have to do a lot of exposure compensation. So right now, for example, in this room, so me looking at all of you sitting here, we have a variety of colors and darkness and brightness where I can take a photo with the camera and trust that it's going to be reasonably accurate with the settings that it's going to pick. However, if if all of you were wearing white, for example, and you were shining a bunch of flashlights into my camera's lens, then I want to portray, or I want to tell the camera that it's actually a lot brighter than it thinks it is, so I have to dial in an increased amount of exposure compensation. So, yes?
I want to get the values backwards. Plus EV means make it brighter?
Or plus EV means make it brighter, that's right. Okay. So when you give it positive exposure compensation, you're telling the camera that you know that, so this basically just reiterates what I said, but you know better than the camera does, and the scene is going to appear to be brighter than what it thinks. So this is a comparison shot of how the camera tries to make things middle gray. So this left shot has no exposure compensation. It has a certain set of values, 1/80th of a second at ISO 400 with an F number of 2.8. You can see that this actually looks very dull in that it's very, very gray. But obviously, this is not how this scene should look. It's a snowy scene, so I have to add some exposure compensation. So after adding in 1.3 stops of exposure compensation, it modifies the exposure values. When it takes the photo again, you'll notice that this white snow is now bright again. So this is what I mean when I'm saying that you're making the photo brighter. You know that snow is going to be brighter than this sort of middle gray, and you need to tell the camera that, because otherwise it's just going to stupidly assume it has no idea what you're looking at. This is a dumb machine. So it's just going to make everything this middle gray, this boring gray. You need to make sure to dial in some exposure compensation so that your snow actually appears white. And so if we are to take a look at these exposure values, so more than just one value has changed, but if we were to figure it out, then you can probably tell that it's just 1.3 additional stops. So whereas this was 1/80th of a second at ISO 400 and f2.8, this one is 1/80th of a second at ISO 800 and f2.5. So the shutter speed is the same. We've increased the ISO, the sensitivity, by one stop, right? So now we have one stop additional brightness in this scene. And then we also decreased the F number by about a third of a stop, from 2.8 to 2.5. And we get the final result, 1.3 additional stops of brightness in this photo. And so what you're doing when you're increasing the exposure, when you're increasing the exposure value here, the exposure compensation, is you are basically forcing an overexposure. So this is what the camera thinks is the proper exposure, but you're telling it, no, 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 I know that this should actually be slightly overexposed. It's not necessarily overexposed because there's still detail in the snow, but you're telling the camera you have to have an additional bit of overexposure in order for it to look correct, for the colors to look right, for the exposure to be correct. Any questions on that? Okay, so the same thing happens for underexposure. So I used last year's example because I really messed up the pinhole camera exposure. I was two stops off when I took the exposure last year, and so I was a lot better this year, thank goodness. But what I had to do then was correct the photo later on in software, which is possible to do, but this is one of the reasons that RAW files are very, very good at what they do, because you can change the exposure compensation in software while retaining a lot of the quality of the original photograph. So anyway, you'll notice here that this is now very, very bright, and so this was an error not on the camera's metering part, but on my part. And so what I had to do later on was dial in a decrease in exposure. So I had to give it negative 2.0, an exposure compensation of negative two stops in order to make it look right. And so there was no sort of math that I used to try to figure this out. There's literally a slider that I had in this software, and I just kept decreasing and decreasing and decreasing until it looked right, until the histogram looked like it gave me a proper exposure. And so if you were to take a look at the technical data down here, you notice that it looks slightly different from the previous one. I mean, besides the fact that it's an extremely long shutter, and so on and so forth, these two actually have the same technical details. They were both taken at about 611 seconds shutter speed, ISO 100, and it had an aperture of about 256 because it's a pinhole, so it's very, very small. And both of these have the same one, but since it was modified in software, I have negative two stops of correction in software because of it. So this can be done in software, but it's almost always better to do it in hardware. So when you're actually taking the photograph, if you take a look at the photo, for example, of snow, and you really notice that it looks gray or it looks darker than it should, and you increase the exposure compensation, it's better to do it then when you're actually at the scene with the camera than to do it later on in software. Because usually, I got lucky with this, but usually decreasing or when adding in a negative exposure compensation in software is actually usually a very, very bad thing to do because you'll get a lot of artifacts. But we'll go over all of that stuff later, as always. So this exposure compensation stuff is really, really useful. If you are in a difficult situation and you're using the mode that's not manual, you absolutely will, and you must use exposure compensation. Maybe not for every image, but you will reach images or situations where you have to dial in some exposure compensation in order to get a properly exposed photograph as it was in the image, in the scene. So even here, for example, in this photograph, I don't remember the exact specs, but you can see that the sun in the sky here was very, very bright. And indeed, what the camera tried to do was make this very, very dark, which made everything very dark, but tried to expose basically for the sky. And so this required some exposure compensation in order to get it correct. Okay. So what are the different types of modes that we have in the camera? So now we have a better understanding of how the camera meters, where it takes, looks at a scene and essentially considers it to be this middle gray when it's looking at all of the light that's coming into it, and it thinks, okay, however much light this is a middle gray, and I will set my exposure values to be reflecting that middle gray. And we have now all of these different modes that uses this information a bit differently. And so this is from the top of a Nikon D40, and you can see that there are a whole bunch of modes, and hopefully by the end of this, if not by the end of this lecture, but by the end of this class, you will look at this and you will say that all of this entire right side is crap and you don't need it. You will mostly use these non-easy modes. A lot of these are really easy, really stupid modes, and the camera just cannot do a better job than you can in determining the exposure for a lot of these settings. So, okay, so let's take a look at some of these. So we have here a fully automatic green section where this is the dumbest of the dumb. It meters the scene, and then it sets all of the values for you, all three, shutter speed, and the ISO and the F number, and it just does it in a very dumb, stupid way. Usually, in some cameras, you can't even set exposure compensation with it. It's so dumb. And so you will, I cannot advocate enough not using the auto mode, unless there is a useful time. There is a time when it is useful, when you are out and about, maybe on a vacation, for example, and you need to give your camera to a stranger. Don't make them fiddle with all the little dials and knobs. Set it to green and let them go. That's the only time that I think it's useful. But anyway, okay. So moving on, let's go counterclockwise. From here, we have a non-flash mode where it's essentially the same as this auto mode, except now if the camera thinks that it needs to use flash, you will force it not to use a flash. Equally dumb, but perhaps a little bit better since you do have some more control. Next, you'll notice it's a person with a hat. This is a portrait image, and typically with portraits, what you want to do is have a very low F number. So you want to have a lot of background blur so that when you focus in on some subject, you will have that subject in focus, and then pretty much everything else behind is lost in the sea of blurriness, of out of focusness. And so that is typically what this mode will do, where it will again modify all three of these modes, but it will bias the F number to be very, very low, and it will adjust the other two settings accordingly. So that's pretty neat. It's but not terribly useful, because now you know what portrait mode does, so you can do the same thing yourself. Okay, so this next one seems to be a picture of a mountain, so we can assume that this is a landscape mode. So most likely it's going to turn off the flash, because the flash, I guarantee, is not going to be powerful enough to light up an entire mountain range. And it will do some other things, like it might increase the F number in this case, because you want to get a lot of the landscape in focus, so it will perhaps bias the F number to be a little bit higher. It might try to bias the ISO to be a bit lower, and hopefully you're using a tripod for a landscape mode, because then you can have very long shutter speed and make things look very smooth, look very, very nice. And so usually that works out pretty well. Okay, sports. Is that the next one? Baby mode. Okay, I have no idea what baby mode means. Probably means a fast shutter speed. It's probably somewhat similar to, I would guess that a baby mode means that it's a combination of a portrait mode and a sports mode, so that it tries to use a low F number so that the baby looks nice, and then there's no, there's a lot of background blur, but then in a sports mode, which would need what?
Stop action.
So a very, very high shutter speed. And so generally what it will do is it'll use the highest shutter speed it possibly can, which means that it has to do what to the F number? Right, very, very low number, the lowest that it can use probably, and sometimes it may even increase the ISO a couple of notches so that you can get an even faster shutter speed. And in fact, if you're taking sports photos, I recommend doing the same thing. Make the F number as low as you possibly can, increase the shutter speed as high as you possibly can, and maybe increase the ISO. Rather than having it be ISO 100 or 200, maybe make it go to 400, 800, 1600 even, if you really need it to really stop that motion. It's generally okay in sports photography to have a little bit of noise when you can really stop the action. And so certainly you'll notice that a lot of sports photographs are done that way. However, if you remember, we had the Olympics just this past summer. And if you ever take a look at the photographers in the Olympics, it can be a little bit out of control and ridiculous. So you'll notice that all of these people are using ridiculously large lenses, which means that they can have, the aperture is very, very big, which means that they can have a very low F number, but also the focal length is very long, so they can really zoom in on the people that they're taking photographs of. With a low F number means that they can increase the shutter speed. So this is really the ideal sort of sports setup. So whether they need an army of photographers, I have no idea. But it certainly is useful when taking sports. A lot of the typical lenses that you use are just not going to be good enough. Sports photography can be very, very expensive, because ideally you would use a very long lens such as this, and literally long, where you have a very long focal length and you can really not only stop the action but capture just a very small subset. It's kind of boring when you take a picture of a football game and the football players are 2 pixels high and the football isn't even present. So certainly all of this stuff is very useful. But I actually have some more cool stuff with the Olympics, but I'm going to wait until the optics lecture to show you that stuff. Okay. So that was my segue into sports, the little running guy. Then you notice there's the flower, the macro mode. This can mean different things to different cameras. On compact cameras, what this will usually mean is that it actually changes the distance that you can focus the lens. So sometimes a lot of lenses, so I have here a macro lens, and many lenses can only focus to a certain distance of them, but some of them can really get in very, very close into and focus on something that's very, very close to the lens itself. And sometimes, though, this additional extension can make the lens very, very slow to focus. And that certainly is the case with this lens here. It takes an age to automatically focus this thing, because it goes through the entire range and zoom and does it very, very slowly. So it zooms out, or it doesn't zoom out, but it focuses to something very, very close, and it realizes, okay, it's not there, and it focuses something very, very far. And anyway, I'm really annoyed with that, so I always have it set to manual focus. But anyway, a lot of the compact cameras will actually limit the degree to which you can zoom in on something unless you're in the macro mode. So you can only zoom in maybe this much, I'm using the wrong term. You can only focus to something this close, for example, rather than allowing this full extension of the focus and allow you to get really close to the subject. Yes?
Is it okay to use the macro mode on the camera that you can do it while it's in manual mode also?
Is it okay to use the, on like a compact camera?
Yeah.
So I don't know if a lot of cameras, so some cameras might have a separate macro button, for example, where you could enable macro mode while you're in the manual metering mode. And that certainly is fine, because that macro button almost certainly means that you're allowing the camera to focus on something closer to it. Whereas this macro mode, for example, is not necessarily a manual mode, it is an automatic mode. And on cameras such as this, it may not mean, so this is why it can get confusing, it can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different cameras. So on this camera, it probably doesn't mean that it's releasing this sort of lock on where you can focus. What this means is that it's altering how it's going to take the photograph. So typically, when you focus on something very, very close to you, you actually get a lot of background blur. So low F numbers become very, very prominent in a macro shot. And so it might try to increase the F number then, so you get a larger depth of field and you can get more of your object in focus. And actually, I have a quick tip for you. If you have a prime lens, so you have to have an SLR for this trick, but if you have a lens that, I guess it can zoom, but I find this easiest with a prime lens, if you, rather than mounting it forwards, so normally we mount the lens like this, if you mount it backwards, so you take it off, you mount it this way, you can usually use this as sort of the poor man's macro lens, and you can get really, really close to an object and take a photo of it. The trick, though, is that macro photography can generally have very, very long shutter speeds, and this can be a problem because you're holding this lens and you're shaking it all over the place. So if you can keep this lens sufficiently still, you can actually get some pretty good macro shots. So certainly give it a try with your lens if you have an SLR camera. It's actually a pretty neat trick, I think, and you will begin to notice this difficulty that we have when taking macro shots, that as you get closer to an object, this depth of field becomes much, much smaller. So just the smallest deviation in focus can really make your whole focus out of whack. So anyway, so generally what a macro mode might try to do then is try to increase the F number so that you have a greater depth of field, and it might try to make the shutter speed as fast as possible so that you have a chance to take a photo of it without it being blurry, in addition to being out of focus. Okay, so let's take a 5-minute break. Welcome back, everybody. So before the break, we were talking about this macro mode. And so someone actually came up and showed me that there's a camera with a macro button. So since I don't know exactly how all of these cameras were constructed, I can only guess have a relatively educated guess about what the difference is between having a macro mode here on one of these meter dials versus having a macro button. So again, if I come back to this lens is a prime lens, so it's only 50 millimeters, but I can zoom from infinity, so something very, very far away, not zoom. That's why I just said prime. I cannot zoom. I can focus from infinity on something very, very far away all the way to 0.062 feet, so just about a couple of inches or so. And you'll notice that this is a very large extension in the focus. However, there's a little switch here that says limit and full. Right now it's on full, which means that I can focus through the entire range. So if I set it on limit, I can now focus only within from infinity all the way, you'll notice that it stops here, to about 0.8 feet or so, which is a pretty reasonable limit when I'm just taking normal photographs, when I'm not actually using a macro when I'm not actually using it in a macro sense. However, when I turn it to full, so this is as much as I can go in limit. If I change it to full, now all of a sudden I can zoom in, focus in, I'm sorry, I can focus in a lot farther. I'm just so used to saying zoom when there's an extension. So anyway, this is most probably what this macro button, if you have a button, this is most probably what this macro button does. It's essentially this limit or full version. So if you don't have the macro button pushed, then you can only focus in on something within maybe 0.8 feet or about a foot or so. But as soon as you push that macro button, now this lens can focus in on something much, much closer. However, if you have a macro mode on a dial such as this, it may or may not do that. So it depends on the camera. In this case, it's an SLR, so you most likely cannot change one of these switches on the SLR by doing that. But if you have this mode on a smaller compact camera, it most likely will enable that feature, so it'll be set to this full focus range now if it has it available, but it will also bias some of these exposure values as we discussed before. So it might increase the F number and try to decrease the shutter speed as best as it can in order to give you a chance to take a sharp macro photo. So you'll have to read the instructions on your camera's documentation to try to get a better idea of what it does, but most likely that is what it is going to do. Okay, so there's also some... So this last icon that's here after the macro is a guy with a star next to him, and that's the sort of night mode, night portrait mode. We can imagine that if you're taking a shot at night, what's going to happen to, say, your shutter speed? Right, it's going to be very low. It's going to be a very long shutter speed. And so this can be quite disastrous when you're trying to take a picture of a person because they're going to move around. Even if they try to remain very, very still, they're going to move around just enough that they'll become blurry in the photograph. And so most likely what's happening here with this night portrait mode is that it'll flip up the flash and it will use not only the flash but a relatively long shutter speed as well so that the person will become sharp because of the flash, but then you'll get some of the background with the long shutter speed as well. And we'll talk more about flash in just a little bit. So some cameras even have a different mode altogether where it's not a night portrait, but it's like a night landscape. So again, there, that'll be a longer shutter speed. It'll probably increase the ISO a little bit, decrease the F number as it can. And if you've rented one of these Lumix, Panasonic Lumix cameras from the 53 Church Street Lab, you'll notice that they have a whole bunch of really ridiculous modes that you will never, ever need. And I think I wrote down some of them here last year in the self-portrait mode, party mode, candlelight mode, sunset mode, fireworks mode, a beach mode, a snow mode. There's so many modes, I don't know how you're going to switch between them fast enough. It's just much easier, I think, to not use any of these modes if you know what you are trying to do. So remember, for this snow mode, what are we going to have to do to the camera if we're going to implement it ourselves?
Increase
the exposure compensation, exactly. So self-portrait, I can only guess. It might fire the flash and it might do some... I don't even know what party mode does. It's also stupid. Okay, anyway, so this now is a metering dial on a different camera. This is on a Canon EOS 5D, which is considered relative... So they have different levels of SLRs. And the 5D is considered to be more professional than the Nikon D40. That isn't to say that the Canon is necessarily more professional, but even my camera here, a 20D, has a lot of these really stupid modes that you can't really see. But once you get to some of these higher level professional cameras, they get rid of these really stupid modes altogether because they hope, or the understanding is that you will use some of these lower level modes, or these modes where you have a lot more control over each of these individual settings. So we have here a green mode, which is actually pretty useful. Like I said, if you're giving the camera to someone else, it's this fully automatic mode. So going clockwise from there, we have a P, which is called a program mode, TV, which is a shutter speed priority mode, AV, which is an aperture priority mode, M, which is a full-on manual, B, which is bulb, And C, let's see, did I write that down? I have no idea what C is. It's probably something, it's probably some fancy feature of the 5D. But okay, so let's go back to this P mode. So this program mode is one step removed from this easier, fully green automatic mode. And usually what happens here is that the camera determines all three of the exposure values for you, but what you get to adjust is some combination of them. So normally the ISO will be fixed, but in program mode, if it determines that the photograph should be, let's see, f4 at 1/100th of a second, for example, you can adjust it so that it no longer is it at f4 and 1/100th of a second, but it might adjust it so that it's at f5.6 and 1/50th of a second. So it adjusts both of those at the same time, if that makes sense, so that the exposure remains the same, but you're adjusting two of these values. So as one increases or decreases, the other one does the opposite to maintain the same exposure, but you can adjust these things. So that's pretty neat, but my favorite modes are the next two, these shutter priority and aperture priority modes, where basically what you do is you set the value you want. So let's take the case of shutter priority. You know that you want to take your photo at 1/500th of a second, for example. You usually will set the ISO by yourself manually as well, because usually you don't set that very frequently. You usually set it to one value and use that for a while. But anyway, then the camera will determine what the F number should be, what the aperture value should be for that particular setting that you want, 1/500th of a second. This is pretty useful, but the light can change very, very rapidly, and generally you'll have to change shutter speed somewhat quickly, even in a given amount of time. So what is perhaps the most popular mode, at least in my case, is the aperture priority mode, where I set the aperture that I want along with the ISO, and then it tells me what it thinks the shutter speed should be. So right now, for example, I should put a lens on it. I'll put this lens on the camera. When I turn it on, set it to the AV or aperture priority mode, and I can see that I have right now at ISO 1600, I have 0.3 seconds shutter speed at f14, which is kind of ridiculous. So I know that it's somewhat dark in this room, so I probably want to decrease the F number a bit so that I will increase the amount of light entering into the lens. So I've set it now to 2.8. When I push the button here, you know, the shutter button, not all the way, but just a little bit, so that it tells me it takes an exposure reading. It now tells me that it's 1/80th of a second. So I've set the ISO manually. I've set the aperture manually because I can know, it makes a lot of sense to me visually to know how much depth of field or how much light I want to enter in through the aperture, and then have the camera suggest what the shutter speed should be based on that. And so imagine what would happen then if I adjust the exposure compensation in this aperture priority mode. So right now it's at, it's actually down a few notches, but if I were to increase the exposure compensation, what is going to change is what the camera says is the shutter speed. So if I go up, let's see, if I go up one stop, then I would expect it to be one stop brighter, which would be 1/40th of a second. That's exactly what the camera shows me. If I were to go down one stop from that previous level, it would be 1/160th of a second. So in this way, it's this give and take, but you can tell the camera exactly what you want to do. And it's actually very, very quick, I think, this mode in particular, especially when compared to the manual mode where you have to manually fine-tune and set all of these things directly. However, the manual mode is also really useful because sometimes you have to completely overrule what the camera thinks should be the exposure, and you have to manually set all of these settings. For example, when I was using the pinhole, the little tiny pinhole device, there was not enough light entering into the camera for it to make an accurate exposure reading. It couldn't tell me how bright or how long the shutter speed needed to be. So I set it to the manual mode, and then using the bulb, I was just able to define how long I wanted the shutter to be open. So in this case, on this camera, they actually have a separate bulb mode. I don't actually know exactly, but I'm sure that you could adjust in the bulb mode the ISO and probably the aperture as well. And then you just have to hold down the shutter in order to keep the shutter open for as long as you want. I actually did a couple of years ago. I was interested to know how often I use the aperture priority mode. Excuse me. And I basically wrote a little program that went through all of the EXIF data and all of the photographs and determined that 96 point something percent of the time I use aperture priority mode, and then that other 3% I use other modes such as the shutter speed priority or the manual mode. And so I'm certainly an advocate of the aperture priority mode, but you may not be yourself. And so just work with each of these and figure out which one works best. For the assignments, you've already had to battle with the manual mode, which is frankly kind of a hassle. And so hopefully now we've sort of graduated from that and you were allowed to use one of these non-easy modes, not the program mode, because it's still setting a lot of the data for you, shutter speed, priority, aperture priority, or the manual mode. And so you have a lot of leeway there. Okay. Any questions on this stuff, on metering? Okay, so remember that when we're talking about exposure, there's actually four things, not just three things, but four things that affect it. Not only do these three values affect it, like we were talking about, the aperture, the sensitivity, and the shutter speed, but also the amount of available light. And that may seem pretty obvious, but it's very easy to forget that this amount of light in the room dictates what all of the other three settings, or what all of the three settings can be. So there are sometimes cases when you just cannot take a photo that you want because you don't have enough light or you have too much light. And so those are the cases when you have to change the amount of available light. And so typically what would we use in this case? So we're talking in generalizations, but yeah, flash is one of the ways, if not the most popular way, of increasing the amount of available light so that you can get a faster shutter speed. You can use a lower ISO or you can use a higher F number. So for a long time, I actually really disliked flash, and I would only use natural light. And whether that meant I could get a photo or not, I really didn't care, because I would only use natural light. And in fact, I still really prefer natural light when possible, because I think it gives very soft, very warm and natural photos that I just really seem to enjoy. And in fact, both of these are, well, it's a photo of my brother and sister. My sister would kill me if she knew I was using this photo now. But both of these were taken with the amount of available light in the room. And so on the left side here, we can see that I used zero exposure compensation. The camera actually did a pretty good job determining. I'm sure I was using aperture mode in this case, or the aperture priority mode. I set it to a relatively low F number because I wanted, it's essentially a portrait, and I wanted to get my brother in focus and the background not in focus. And so I used relatively low F number at 2.5, set the ISO somewhat high because I was indoors, the ISO 800, and then let the camera tell me what the shutter speed should be. So in this case, it was 1/320th of a second, which is fast enough. If you remember the trick from last year, if you have a focal length, you can generally hand hold the camera at 1/1 the focal length to determine the speed that you can hold the camera. So if I was using the 50 millimeter lens, then I could hold this, you know, as slow as 1/50th of a second, for example. But when using this aperture priority mode, you can tell very easily if you'll be able to take a photo or not based on what the camera tells you is the shutter speed. So if the shutter speed is too slow, you can perhaps increase the ISO or decrease the F number in order to get a faster shutter speed and be able to get the photo. Okay, so using a flash, though, is very, very useful, and you can take gorgeous photos with flash. But before we get into that, I want to talk just a little bit about it. So usually the flash, when you take a flash, it's very, very quick. It's quicker than the iris can adjust, and this can cause some problems for us later. But a flash can also be somewhat distracting during sports. So if you are taking photographs of a sports game, you may not want to distract the players, and flash can sometimes do this. So sometimes you're stuck with natural light in cases like that. And so it really depends on the situation whether or not you can use flash. Typically, this is what we see or what we think of when we think of flash. It's a little pop-up unit that may not pop up. Compact cameras especially may just be built in, and it's usually slightly higher than the lens itself. And when you take a photo, it flashes. That's pretty much it. But you have to realize that there's a lot going on when we're taking a flash photograph. And so unfortunately, we have to go back a little bit and talk about some math. So when we have a light source, so let's say we have a flashlight, or we have the sun, or we just have some source of light. A flash, for example, it emits light, and the light goes in every direction. So with the sun especially, it's round and spherical, so the light goes everywhere and emanates from that point. But as you get farther and farther away, that light is still diverging. It's not becoming parallel. It's still diverging. So as you get farther and farther away, that light, you get less and less photons to a particular location, so you get less, you don't have as much brightness, essentially. As you increase your distance away from a source of light, you are decreasing the brightness that you perceive from it. And there is actually a law that tells you exactly how much light you are going to lose based on how much distance you get from it, and that is the inverse square law. So for every increase in distance, you actually have to square that distance, and that's how much less light you get. So let me explain. So here we have, for example, a source of light, just right here at this little point, and it is giving off light rays, and the light rays are diverging. So you can see here, just imagine for now that we have each of these rays of light is one photon as it moves along in its path. And so right here we have just some particular area. So imagine that it's an aperture, for example, or the iris in your eye that's capturing a certain number of photons. And we are just a distance r away from that point source. So as we increase our distance to twice that distance, so no longer we are distance away from that point source, but now we are 2r, those light rays have diverged to such a point that we only get a quarter of the amount in that same square. So you'll notice that we have this one square here, and now it takes four squares in order to get the same amount of light. And this is where that square comes in. So as we double the amount, as we double the distance, we have to take two squared, and that is how much we decrease the intensity of our light. So there's a big fancy equation for it that you could figure out with the sphere, but basically all you have to remember is that as you double it, you are in effect, as you double the distance, you are decreasing, or you are getting only a quarter the intensity of the light than you were from the previous location. And same thing with when you triple it, so you have to take three squared and you get about a ninth of the distance of light. So you can imagine that this can become quite problematic with flash. When I take a flash photograph, somebody that's 1 foot away from me, for example, will be getting four times the amount of light than somebody that's 2 feet away from me. And it just gets worse as you get farther and farther away. So this light falls off, what we call falls off, it just becomes very dispersed and no longer really helps out after a certain distance away from the flash. And so this is why flash can be very, very harsh light, especially you can very well expose a subject that's some number of feet away from you, but then immediately behind them, it's just a lot darker. And that's the reason why, is that the light falls off very, very quickly, especially when we're talking about flash or any source of light. And so a lot of manufacturers give a number or a value to flashes to tell you approximately how powerful that light is. So I have to hit you with some more math, but it's relatively simple. The guide number, which is what manufacturers use as the intensity of the flash, is the distance times the F number. So what does this mean? So let's say that I have a guide number of, let's say, 13 meters, and realize that the guide number is usually given in terms of distance, so meters or feet. So if I have a guide number of 13 meters, which is actually the guide number of my flash here on my 20D, I can convert it to feet, and I get it's about 39.3 feet, or I'll just round it to about 40 feet, which means that I have a guide number here of 40 feet on this camera. Okay, so what does this mean? Now, when they told me the guide number, they said this is the guide number at ISO 100. So at ISO 100, what this means is that I have a guide number of 40 feet. So let's say that I am using a lens, and this one I'll set it to F4, for example. So now I have an F number of 4. I can figure out exactly how far this flash will travel and properly illuminate an object. So that is this distance that it is referring to. So the guide number is 40 feet at ISO 100. If I have my camera set to ISO 100, the guide number of 40 feet, and I have an F number of 4, what is the maximum distance that an object can be for me to properly expose it? 10 yeah, 10 feet. It's pretty easy to do that math. Right. Well, yes, that's right. So it is the distance that we could use. So, well, we could do some other tricks like increase the F number, decrease the ISO, for example, if possible, so that the flash doesn't appear as bright. And that is exactly what happens. So the flash gives off a certain amount of light. If we were to increase this ISO to, let's do it a different way. Rather, let's say that we will now open up the aperture by one stop. So rather than having it be F4, what will be the aperture? 2.8. That's right, 2.8. So let me write this stuff down so that it doesn't become too cumbersome. Give me 1 second so I can make the text bigger so that everybody can read it. Okay. So I claim that the guide number is the distance times the F number. But then my guide number on my camera is 40 feet. And we said that with that guide number at ISO 100, I have a distance, I can expose something 10 feet away with an F number of F4, for example, right? So now what happens if I decrease to this lower aperture, or this lower F number at ISO 100 times F2.8. So now one stop brighter in the aperture, we get this big question mark. So if we do the division, we actually figure out that it's about 14 feet. So you'll notice that again, we don't get this really nice halving or doubling of numbers. It seems to be related to this diameter problem that we were having before. Where if we increase the aperture by one stop, we can now extend our subject by 4 feet. And so we can keep going on and on and on and try to figure out where exactly all of this stuff is. But what happens then? Okay, so let's say that I'm at ISO 200 and I still have this guide number of 40 feet, but it's at ISO 100, okay? And now I go back to 40 feet at ISO 200 equals how much times F4. So now what I've done is I've gone back to the original F number, F4, and I've increased the ISO, I've increased the sensitivity by twice. What happens here is exactly the same thing as previously. We get 14 feet. So whether I increase, it doesn't matter how I increase the stop. Whether I do it based on the aperture or whether I do it based on the ISO, we are now saying that we can allow additional light in. So now this flash can illuminate an object 14 feet away at either ISO 200 and F4 or at ISO 100 and 2.8. So you can do this calculation to figure out exactly where exactly where your subject should be in order for you to properly expose it, but this can be quite a hassle, as you can see. So, but it is important because it tells us exactly It tells us the flash power, essentially, or how much power the flash is giving off. And usually, just like many other numbers that flashes or that manufacturers give off, these numbers can be embellished a little bit, and they'll try to really focus in on the guide number. But you can use it as a good general guideline to determine how powerful one flash is compared to another. So all of this time, you might be saying, well, what about the shutter speed? I haven't really talked at all about shutter speed. So realize that, just take it for granted for now, that there is a set shutter speed that you should use when using flash, and it's usually 1/250th of a second. It's always called the X sync speed, or it's the maximum speed, the maximum shutter speed that your camera can be set to in order to properly take a flash photograph. And what this means, the reason that it doesn't really matter, is that the flash gives off a certain amount of light, and it does it very, very quick, very, very quickly. It just does it really quick. And so it really doesn't matter if you decrease the shutter speed to 1/125th of a second, for example, because it's the same amount of light emitted by the flash, so you're not really getting much additional light. And I'm assuming here that there's no other light that's entering into the camera. But that's why it really doesn't matter. You can set it to the maximum speed possible by the camera and just rely on adjusting the ISO and adjusting the F number to determine the exposure that is being set in this particular case. And so usually what a lot of flash units will have is, not in this case because this is a pretty automatic flash, but a lot of manual flashes will actually have like a little calculator on it, or a little device that you can use to try to figure out what ISO and what aperture you should use depending on the distance away the person is. So you can set it, so for example, there might be if there was a little slider on this flash, for example, I could say that, okay, I know my subject is 14 feet away. It could say, well, you could either use ISO 100 with an F number of 2.8, or you could use ISO 200 with an aperture of F4. And that's all assuming that you have this X sync speed, that the shutter speed set to the maximum shutter speed available to us in the camera. So the guide number, the calculation is pretty easy to do, but it can get difficult when you're trying to do it on the fly or when you're trying to do it on the spot. So usually you should rely on these calculators in order to calculate what settings you should use. However, these are only for manual flashes. A lot of flash units that are on the camera will actually try to determine a lot of this stuff for you. For example, remember that I said the camera knows how far away the subject is when I focused in on it. The lens communicates back to the camera body and it says, okay, the subject is 14 feet away. So then the camera automatically knows, okay, at this ISO, at ISO 400 or at ISO 100, I must use an F number of 2.8 in order to properly expose the person. And so this is sort of the calculation that the camera uses internally to figure out how what settings it should use in order to adjust the exposure values for the image. So using a manual flash is actually pretty neat because you can do this. You don't have to do the calculation by yourself, but you can use this little dial or the slider that a number of flashes have, and you can determine exactly what settings you should use. You'd have to refer to your manual flash unit yourself. But to take a step back and talk again about the X sync speed, why do we have this limitation on the shutter speed? If the light is so quick, why can't I use, say, 1/4,000th of a second or 1/8,000th of a second? Why am I limited to 1/250th or 1/500th of a second? And the reason is the shutter itself. So we now have to go further into the anatomy of a camera to understand why this is the case. So when we're talking about shutters, it's usually two curtains, as they call them, and they move across the sensor to expose the sensor to the image. So let's see. I will take these two sheets of paper as an example. Pretend that these two pieces of paper are my shutter. So I could have a sensor right here, And normally when the shutter is closed, they're both covering the sensor so that no light reaches the sensor itself. So you'll notice that now this diagram shows us a couple of different ways that shutters can move across the image. So for right now, let's just assume that we have one shutter over the sensor, and that I have another shutter that's released here. Okay, so when we push the shutter button on the camera, the shutter must move out of the way. So this one moves out of the way, and then the camera knows at times how long it's been open. So let's say I have it for 1 second. So as soon as this starts moving, it's 1 second long, and then after that, it starts closing this one. And so the timing works because as soon as I start showing light onto this portion of, so this is the first portion of the sensor that's getting light. As I move this across, all of the sensor is getting the same amount of time because I have an adjacent curtain that comes to close the shutter at a specific time. So there's a couple of different ways that they can get these to work. So one way is to completely open this shutter or this curtain, then it'll stay open and then they'll start closing the other one. So in this way, the entire image or the entire sensor is exposed to some amount of light just at a constant, for a constant amount of time. So there is a point in time where the whole thing is exposed. However, they can only make these curtains move so quickly in a camera. So they really can't move at 1/8,000th of a second in this way. It's just too fast. It'll break things internally. So they came up with this other way of being able to increase the shutter speed even faster. And that is where they both move at the same time and only show a little bit of the sensor, or show a little bit of the light to the sensor at, for a given amount of time. So faster than some speed, the camera is going to have to move both curtains simultaneously in order to make sure that each portion of the sensor is only shown for however long the shutter speed is. So you can imagine that this can cause some interesting problems. First of all, what happens at this end of the camera is going to be some number of time away from this end of the sensor. And so usually when we're talking about shutter speeds that are this quick, it's really not too big of a deal. You really are not going to notice the difference in the light between that hits it here and hits it here. It's only thousandths of a second apart. But what happens is that the flash happens very, very quickly. It happens so quickly that these two curtains cannot move across. And when the flash happens, it's only going to happen at one instant. So the flash will only expose, for example, this portion of the sensor. So on the final image, then you would only see a little strip of light that the flash is exposed, and the rest will be completely dark. And that is the reason that we have this X-sync speed. That is the fastest speed in which the first curtain opens and the entire sensor is completely exposed to light. Once that first curtain is out of the way, the flash fires and the entire sensor is exposed to the light, to the flash light. Then the other can close and you have taken your exposure. So that cannot happen when you're moving both across at the same time. Sometimes when you're just a little bit faster than the X-sync speed, so maybe 1/300th of a second, for example, they won't move so close together, but this one will move almost all the way, maybe 80%, 90%, and then this one will start to close behind it. And so you would typically see if you try to take a photograph with a flash and you're overriding your X-sync speed, you will typically see just a portion of the image blacked out. So it might be one of the sides. So this is a side-to-side shutter. Typically, we don't see this anymore. We typically see a horizontal or a vertical shutter because there's less distance for the shutter to have to travel. But we do see both kinds. And so typically what we'll see is a shutter that operates this way, but the principle is the same. It'll work over the shorter distance rather than the longer distance. Yes?
Do digital SLRs actually have a mechanical focal plane, or is it approximated
electronically? No, digital SLRs do have a mechanical focal plane. They also have mechanical shutters. But yeah, it is a good point. Many cameras don't actually have, especially compact cameras, don't actually have this mechanical shutter. So if you have a compact camera, you may not have an X-sync speed problem at all, because if the shutter is electronic, then it, the whole thing will be exposed to light anyway. And as fast as you want your shutter speed to be, that's exactly the amount of light that you will get from the flash. So this really is only a problem when we have manual or actual physical shutters that exist. These electronic shutters that, that exist in camera phones and compact cameras, they don't have this problem. So this is one of the advantages that a smaller camera can have over an SLR. Okay, but so that is, so the camera then has to be able to fire the flash exactly when these two shutters are exactly open. It can't be anywhere in between, otherwise we get some weird black band or dark band in the photograph. And this is the problem with X-sync speed. However, modern flashes are really, really, really fast. Typically, they can give out their entire flash burst in about 1/1000th of a second to even as fast as 1/32000th of a second. And so that will generally be way, that will always be way too fast for you to try to overcome with the X-sync speed. Okay, so like I said, these can actually be very, very fast, and it is possible to take an image of some event that's really quick, even though you have this X-sync speed limitation. So remember that I said that flashes can be, even flashes that you can buy, maybe not ones built in, but the external flash units that you can buy can be as quick as maybe 1/32000th or 1/64000th of a second. And what you can do is you can keep your shutter open. So imagine now that I'm not worrying about X-sync speed or having it be open for 1/250th of a second. Counterintuitively, let's say that I keep it open for 5 seconds or 6 seconds in a completely dark room. And then all of a sudden some event happens and I fire a flash at the fastest possible strobe, the fastest possible flash that I possibly can. I will only get illuminated, or the sensor will only be illuminated for that brief amount of time. And so you can get some events that happen very, very quickly by using this sort of counterintuitive method where you actually don't increase the shutter speed, you decrease it, make the shutter open for much longer. And as long as you get the timing right between the flash actually firing and some event actually happening, you can essentially freeze time. And so this sort of idea was pioneered by Dr. Edgerton, and he actually worked at MIT for a while, and they have some pretty neat stuff in the museum about some of his work. And he really has pioneered, or he had pioneered a lot of this really fast stopping motion, really fast objects or events that can happen in time. So normally, you can, when you make a flash faster, you're going to also decrease the amount of light that's given off by it. So let's say I go back to this fictional flash that I have that fires at 1/1000th of a second. It gives off its full amount of power, its full brightness at 1/1000th of a second. However, if I make it slightly faster, so rather than 1/1000th, I make it 1/2000th of a second, it's only going to be giving off half as much light because it can only fire for half as long. So just like we can only capture a certain amount of light by increasing or decreasing the shutter speed by half or doubling it, the same thing with flashes. So we can make it as fast as possible, but we also lose that much light. So if we go from 1/1000th of a second to maybe 1/32000th of a second, we will only have 1/32 of the power, which would be what? That's about 6 stops, I think. So that's 6 stops less light. But if you're in a completely dark room, that should actually be enough. And you can notice one of the things about this image is that it's pretty grainy. So they did actually have to increase the ISO or the sensitivity of the film in order to properly get in order to properly capture the amount of light that's given off. Okay, so what's wrong with flash? So this is a horrible photo of my brother and sister from a long time ago. And you can see that I was using the sort of night landscape mode, and I was trying to take a photo of them, but there's a lot of problems here. First, there's motion blur, then there's red eye, then the background is completely worthless. You can see how quickly the light falls off from the flash unit here, and this is one of the reasons why I don't like flash, is because this happens almost all of the time when you're just using the built-in flash, but there are ways around it. Okay, so what causes red eyes? So just very, very quickly, the light comes in through the iris, reflects off the back of the eye, which is red, comes back into the camera lens, and you get red-eyed. Because the back of the eye is red, you're just getting a reflection of the light off of the back of the eye, and it becomes red. So if it's this sort of straight-on light that bounces off the back of the eye and comes back as red, how can we eliminate red eye without using software or any of this sort of stuff? What can we do to a flash to fix red eye? If the light comes in through the eye, through the front of the eye, and then bounces straight back out, how can we fix this?
Flash at an angle?
Yeah, so we can put the flash at an angle. So if the flash is higher off of the camera, for example, the light will come down this way rather than coming straight on through the iris, and the light will probably reflect off this way and back up towards the flash, but we won't see that because we are looking straight on. So that is certainly one way to be able to do this. You can, if you move the flash off the camera, and this is when flash can become very, very powerful, you don't use one of these crappy flash units that are just on top of the lens because you will almost always get red eye. Move it off of the camera, and then you will be able to get a lot of, you'll be able to fix a lot of the problems. And indeed, one of the problems that you see here, it might be sort of difficult, you can sort of see it here, is that you get this immediate shadow directly behind the person. And that's because you are illuminating the person or the subject themselves, but not what is directly behind them. The flash casts a shadow, you're recording that shadow. If you move the flash off the camera, maybe much, much higher, for example, the shadows are much lower and you won't necessarily capture them in the photo either. So moving the flash off of the camera is one of the best things that you can do to really increase or really get some really good flash photos out there. So, all right, so you can move it just using a bracket like this, or you can move it onto a completely separate area and try to do something fancy with lighting. But what about this problem that we have here where we get some motion blur? We'll realize that this motion blur is because we kept the shutter open for a certain amount of time, and that the kids, or my brother and sister, were moving just so slightly in the 2 seconds that the shutter was open. And so we were able to record that, especially up here in the background where we could see some of the moon and the clouds. Okay, so remember that I said that when we have the X shutters or the X sync speed, this curtain moves out of the way, the flash is fired, and then some amount of time later, this is closed. So we can actually get different effects determining when the flash is fired. And this is called front and rear curtain sync. So you can imagine that it looks different if we fire the flash as soon as we move this first curtain, as soon as we move this front curtain, then we fire the flash, then maybe, you know, just a few hundredths of a second later, we start closing this one. Or if we move this one out of the way, wait a few hundredths of a second, then fire the flash, and then close this curtain, we get different results. And that's exactly what happens here. So if we take a photo where the flash fires at the beginning, you freeze the motion at the beginning of the action. So you see the biker here, for example, we have frozen that motion at the beginning, and then he drives off. You'll notice that we get this weird backwards trail. That's because we've frozen the motion at the beginning of the action and not at the end. Where if we use rear curtain sync, where we opened the shutter or we opened the curtain, some amount of time has elapsed, so enough time for him to move, then right before we close it, we fire the flash and then close the shutter, we're able to capture the action at the end of the motion. So some cameras will have the capability to change the curtain sync. Sometimes it's called rear curtain sync, sometimes it's called second curtain sync. But if you want to portray motion, generally you want to have the flash fire at the end or using this rear curtain sync. Okay, so there are also some flash capabilities where we can fire the flash multiple times. These are called stroboscopic flashes, and this is an example of one stroboscopic flash, and again, this is by Dr. Edgerton, where you can see the entire motion, but not in this motion blur. We're actually stopping unique pieces of time throughout the motion using a stroboscopic flash. So just like it sounds, it's essentially like a strobe where it flashes several times in very rapid succession. We're able to do that to freeze some amount of time. And so higher end flash units will actually use this to allow you to override the X-sync speed without you getting this weird artifact or this darkening of the frame that I had mentioned before. So what the flash will do is it will fire at lower power, but it will fire constantly, so one right after the other, and this will allow the flash to be open for maybe the 1/500th of a second that's necessary for this first curtain to move across, and as that first one is moving across and the second one moves across, the flash can stroboscopically illuminate the subject for long enough so that you can override this X-sync speed. And so that's a pretty neat feature, but not all flashes have that. And so you should just realize that it's available to you, but you lose some of the power available for the flash because of that. Okay, so just quickly, this is an old flash. You can see that there's a little dial on the corner of this flash, and once you learn how to use it, it will use that guide number function or equation to tell you exactly what the settings you should use are for this particular flash. Being that it is an old flash, it probably does not have the capabilities to override the X-sync speed, so you would set your camera to the X-sync speed, and based on how far the subject is, you would use the little calculator to determine what ISO and what F number you should use, and you would set it. So if you have an old flash like this, the only thing I would suggest that you be careful with is that these really old ones can actually cause very high voltages over the terminal, the flash terminal that exists here. And our new cameras, a lot of these electronic and digital cameras, don't like that. And so if you have a very old flash, there's a website that you should look up first that will tell you whether or not your flash is safe to use on a modern camera. If you buy a modern flash, this isn't going to be too big of a deal. But basically, I'll post this on the website a little bit later, but you can look up the manufacturer and the model of these flashes. So that one was a Vivitar 283. I don't want to waste a lot of time looking through it, but you can see that they measure the voltages that the flashes give off when they're fired. They'll tell you whether or not it's safe. Generally, you want a very, very low voltage emitted by the flash in order to do it. Okay, so flash can actually be very, very useful, not only for adding additional, to add additional light, but one of the benefits about it is that you can do what's called fill flash, where if you have a subject that's very underexposed, then you want to expose not only the subject, but also the background, you can use fill flash in this case. So in this case, had I increased the exposure compensation, I could make the subject here exposed properly, but then the background would be overexposed. If you use fill flash, you can actually, so there's a little bit of a flash remnant here that you could probably eliminate had you used an off-camera flash, for example, but you can do what's called flattening the dynamic range, or you can bring this darker area of the image to be brighter and more in line with the background here. The problem with using fill flash is that sometimes the lens gets in the way of the flash, especially when you're using large lenses that can interfere with the lower part of the flash. And so you have to be careful when using very wide lenses, for example. This is a photo when taken very, very zoomed out, so I was very, very close here, and what happens is that there is actually a curve down here that you can see, perhaps not very well on this image, but if you were to download the slides and look at them, there's very obvious change in the amount of light from which there is fill flash up here and there is no flash down here because it is being blocked by the lens, And you get this sort of a strange, eerie-looking contrast that really should not be present. And that's because if I had zoomed in a little bit, then this portion down here that was being blocked would not actually exist in the image, but that is no fun. So of course, again, the solution to this is to move the camera or to move the flash off of the camera or to zoom in or to do some other variation like that. Okay, so I'm sorry I ran a little over again, but next week we will talk about optics. Thank you all for coming.